You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, live from, it's the day before May Day, live from Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, we will be bringing you reports from all over the country as May Day rolls out. May Day has been, in the past, I mean, there's a long history of May Day. It's associated with Beltane, with fertility festivals, the Maypole, all kinds of stuff like that. But then in the 1880s, things changed when American workers stood up, leading to the ultimately in Chicago, the Haymarket Square, so-called riots, and which actually was a setback for the American labor movement, but created an international labor movement, which defined May 1st as International Workers' Day. Over 80 countries recognize it as such. The United States is not one of them. But, you know, there's a lot of us who are trying to bring that back, bring back that memory, make that happen, make people aware of it. And so tomorrow's going to be the day for that. It's going to be a very, very interesting day. Meanwhile, you know, I have told you many times, and I keep saying this, and this is not a partisan shtick, okay? There's no Republicans bad, Democrats good in this. This is true of some Democrats as well. But it's absolutely true of virtually the entire Republican Party, and that is that the only way that they can win elections is by lying. And it is now, and they do it just, you know, bald-facedly. And here, for example, the guy, Eric Fenstrom, was the guy who was asked a few weeks ago, you know, how's Romney going to do in the general election when he took all these extreme right-wing positions during the primaries? And he said, oh, well, you know, it'll be like an Etch-a-Sketch. We're going to reboot the campaign. And everybody was like, what? The Etch-a-Sketch has begun. And it was Eric Fenstrom himself. You'll recall back in 2008 when there was a big debate about what should happen to the auto companies that were teetering on the edge. This was in the tail end of the Bush administration. And George W. Bush was inclined to bail them out, and Barack Obama supported bailing them out because millions of jobs would have been lost, not just in the auto industry, but in all the feeder industries for them all across the United States. And Mitt Romney wrote an op-ed that was published in the New York Times called Let Detroit Go Bankrupt. And his claim was that it should be a managed bankruptcy. In other words, it should be done by the private sector. Now, the problem was, as any idiot could tell you, private sector banks were not loaning money for companies that were going through bankruptcy. So had this been done the way that Romney was proposing, Chrysler would no longer exist, GM would no longer exist. Yeah, they'd probably be making more Toyotas down at the Toyota plants and in the right to work for less states. But, you know, Detroit would, it would be a disaster. So that's the background. So Eric Fenstrom, you know, Romney's advisor, Romney's surrogate, comes out on Saturday and says this to the media. Romney's position on the bailout was exactly what President Obama followed. Now, I'm not making it up and I'm not paraphrasing. These are his exact words. His position on the bailout was exactly what President Obama followed. I know it infuriates them to hear that. Now, maybe the reason it infuriates them to hear that is because it's a lie. Anyhow, I know it infuriates them to hear that the only economic success that President Obama has had is because he followed Mitt Romney's advice. This is the message that is going to be echoed 100,000 times on Fox so-called news. Right-wingers all across America, they are shaking the Etch-a-Sketch. They are lying. As I've said over and over and over again, the only way these guys, these conservatives, whether they be Republicans or the few conservative Democrats out there, the only way that they can get elected, given that in modern parlance, conservative means something very different than it did in the days of Everett Dirksen and Barry Goldwater. What it means now is standing up for the large corporations, the transnational corporations, and the billionaires who want to manipulate and mess with the system to their own advantage, rather than standing up for the average working person. That's what it means. That's what conservative means in today's. I mean, there's just no other way to define it. It's very clear. It's very obvious. It's very straightforward. And if your agenda is supporting, you know, the 1%, that's the only thing, that's all you're about. And the 1% is going to toss hundreds of millions, billions of dollars into the campaign to help you win the presidency so that you can pack even more right-wingers on the Supreme Court. And, I mean, we were having this conversation last night. Richard Green, who's an attorney, was here, and he was talking with Jay Goodman Tamboli, who's an attorney and the Supreme Court reporter for Talk Radio News, and spends a lot of time down at the Supreme Court. And, you know, we're all speculating about, you know, what would happen if Romney becomes president and, say, for example, God forbid, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she's quite elderly. She's had cancer a couple times. She were to decide to retire. Or Kennedy, the swing vote, retires. But more importantly, one of the liberal justices, in quotes. And Romney, who has said he's going to put somebody in the model of Sam Alito on there, he's going to put another Scalia on the bench. I think, you know, I mean, I don't think it's just a matter of rolling back Roe v. Wade. You're going to see Brown versus Board of Education rolled back. You're going to see the 1937 cases that declared, I mean, the Supreme Court was fighting FDR for years and years and years, and finally, you know, after he tried court packing scheme failed, but what it did successfully was it caused everybody in America to realize how important or how much power the Supreme Court had. And what kind of consequence that had to Americans. And all of a sudden, the Supreme Court started going along. You know, they had said earlier child labor laws were unconstitutional. You get a Romney court, that's what you're going to see. They had said that it was unconstitutional for the federal government or any government to have laws passed that allow labor unions to exist. That employers should be able to break unions at will, as they did until the mid-1930s. Workplace safety rules are unconstitutional, as they were until the mid-1930s. And people routinely died. Actually, that goes back a little earlier, maybe 20 years earlier. I think the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire was, as I recall, in 1913, and it was 2 years after that that the first OSHA law was put into place. But it was very, very modest. So anyhow, the Etch-a-Sketch has begun. Meanwhile, the Wall Street banks, and the Center for American Progress is doing a great job of getting some of this stuff out over at thinkprogress.org. The Wall Street banks are characterizing themselves as elk who are about to be circled by wolves. It seems to me like they're the predators. Maybe I'm missing something. And CISPA, the Cybersecurity Act here, the Cyber Intelligence Sharing and Protection Act. This is probably the worst piece of legislation to come down the road in a long, long time. It basically turns control of the Internet over to big transnational corporations and allows them to share all of your private information with each other, and you never know, or with the federal government, and you never know what's going on. And it's written so broadly that basically we're all going to be under the scrutiny of Big Brother, and Big Brother is not just going to be the government. It's going to be any corporation that wants to know about you, or frankly, it could be any foreign country. Kiss your privacy goodbye. So Microsoft is reconsidering this. The Republicans overwhelmingly passed it in the House of Representatives last week. Now it goes to the Senate. We'll see where that happens.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Why is Ronald Reagan responsible for the epidemic of obesity in America? That right after this.
No banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I.
Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Senator Jeff Merkley is on the line with us. Senator, the Democrat from Oregon, of course, and merkley.senate.gov, his website. Senator, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. I understand that you are aggressively working to get the Volcker Rule passed. Tell me about that.
Well, the key now is that it passed, of course, in statutes as part of Dodd-Frank, but Wall Street is focused on dismantling it in the regulatory process and the writing of the regulations, and they're having a lot of success. They're managing to create rules, and let me just back up and say this is the firewall between banks making loans and hedge funds. And you do not want the hedge funds inside the banks, because when the hedge funds blow up, as they periodically do, they take the banking system down with them. And
which is what happened in 2008.
Everybody needs, exactly. And it happened in the Great Depression. It happened in 2008. And we need to say, if you want to gamble on high-risk adventures, do so. But do it in a hedge fund that's outside the banking system.
Right.
It's a pretty simple concept, and the regulators are turning in the most convoluted rules ever seen on this planet. And Wall Street has teams of lawyers trying to make sure that's the case, so that they can basically keep engaging in what's called proprietary trading or the hedge fund business instead of making loans to our banks and to our families and our businesses.
So what, for the average person who's listening, what can they do to, you know, this seems, I think, probably to some people rather arcane, and yet it's really, this is where the proverbial rubber meets the road. I mean, this is, having banks that have integrity and having a financial system that has some integrity to it is critical for anything, for everything, for you to have your job, to have, you know, to get a mortgage, whatever it may be. What should people be doing right now?
Well, they should definitely be letting their members of Congress know they're not happy with the dismantlement, the attempted dismantlement of this firewall. I think folks have read recently about MF Global, a major hedge fund that blew up. That did not hurt the banking system because it wasn't inside a bank.
Right.
But it's a reminder of the fact that when you take high risks with strategies based on derivatives and based on expectations about the energy market, et cetera, those strategies will sometimes be right and sometimes be wrong. When they go wrong, then you lose your money as an investor. That's fine. When they go right, you make money. But it should be outside the banking system. Because otherwise our small business can't get loans. And I can tell you, I'm on the road right now in Oregon. I'm calling you from the road. And I'm doing town halls, and I hear from person after person who wants to know why it is the banks are sitting on money and they're not making loans to small businesses and families.
And it's because they can...
The answer is the big banks, they'd rather be making hedge fund investments.
Right. So basically, you deposit money with banks. Traditionally, what those banks did is they took those deposits, leveraged them slightly, through the technicalities of fractional reserve banking, and loan those out as mortgages and car loans. Now they're taking your deposits and they're gambling with them on Wall Street because they've been able to become gamblers as well, you know, gambling banks, so-called investment banks, as well as regular old-fashioned commercial banks. And so it should be no surprise that they'd rather, you know, gamble on Wall Street than give you a mortgage at 3.5% or 4% or whatever they are these days. So, not only does putting the Volcker Rule back into place make sense in that it will hopefully avoid another crash. I mean, we went from the George Washington administration until 1935. This country never went more than 15 years without a major banking panic. Never, ever. And from 1935 until Reagan deregulated the thrifts in 84 and then leading to that crash in 86, there was no banking panics. Why? Because of Glass-Steagall.
50 years of a pretty solid foundation.
Yeah, there you go. And even that was a small compared to what happened in 2008 because Phil Graham, you know, did away with the Glass-Steagall Act. So this is an attempt to I think a small and measured attempt, but still a good one to put this firewall back into place. Now, who's fighting against this, and where is this happening at the regulatory level or the congressional level?
Yeah, no, it's virtually all regulatory level, and their goal is to basically make the rules that divide, and I say their goal, Wall Street's goal is to make the rules that divide hedge fund investing from wealth management and market making so complicated that they can essentially put the hedge fund inside the market making unit or inside the wealth management unit. And their other strategy is to simply delay implementation. There's a deadline coming up in July. The rules are supposed to be in place. They've had 2 years. There's absolutely no reason they shouldn't be in place. But Wall Street feels that they can delay them long enough, and not let them become the established, acceptable rule of law, they can come back to a future Congress and get them rolled back more easily.
These rules, though, are being promulgated by whom? Who's putting these rules
together? By a combined set of the regulators, SEC, the FDIC, and a couple of others.
Now, all of them, they work for the president. They're in the executive branch. Why doesn't he just put his foot down?
Well, I can't speak for the president, but I think he is encouraged. He did support the Volcker Rule. I think he is encouraging them to proceed. But he's got to deal with a few other things at the same time.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to.
So why? But if we call our members of Congress, we ask them to do what?
Tell them to let the regulators know they've got to get the Volcker firewall, and I'd call it the firewall because folks forget what it is. But if you call it the Volcker firewall, that between the hedge funds and the banks that make loans, that's essential to our long-term stability, and tell the regulators to quit messing around and get it done.
Right, that's so these exactly regulators can basically be lobbied by members of Congress just like they can be lobbied by the banks, and we can lobby them through our members of Congress.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
It's very hard to lobby. Look, you know, they do have comment periods where folks put in lots of comments. Those comment periods are over on these regulations, and quite frankly, I'm not sure that they much pay much attention unless the letter is coming from a big, powerful financial institution.
But or a member of Congress.
Yeah, they do pay more attention to members of Congress.
Right. So contact your member of Congress and say you want the Volcker firewall in place. Senator Jeff Merkley, merkley.senate.gov, the website. Senator Merkley, thanks so much for being with us, and thanks for the great progressive work that you're doing in the United States Senate.
Thanks, Tom. You bet.
Good talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Okay, right after this, as promised, why Ronald Reagan is responsible for an obesity epidemic and your calls. Okay, a couple of other stories here that I think are really worthy of sharing with you and all of us considering as Americans the consequence and importance of these. First of all, in San Francisco, there's this thing called BART. If you've ever been to San Francisco, the Bay Area Rapid Transit, it's their equivalent in San Francisco of the metro system here in Washington, D.C. It's a very high quality, state-of-the-art subway system. And they're buying new cars, new train cars for it. Now, you would think, wow, isn't that cool? You know, you can, an American company could be making train cars and supplying them to BART in San Francisco and more jobs. But there were only two companies that did the bidding or that were the top two bidders. One was a company known as Alstom, which is out of France. And the other was a company called Bombardier, and they're out of Canada. Now, Bombardier said they would source 66%, two-thirds of the stuff that goes into these trains, into these new train cars, from U.S. manufacturers. The French said they would source 95%. From U.S. manufacturers. But the Canadians made a lower offer because they were bringing in some stuff from cheap labor countries. And so the wise elders in San Francisco gave the contract to them. And in either case, I mean, this is just the clear consequence of our not having any kind of national infrastructure system. I mean, we're talking about subway cars, right? We're not even talking about high-speed rail. China has just laid 5,000 miles of high-speed rail over the last 6 or 7 years. How much do we have? Zero. We were going to have a piece of high-speed rail between Tampa and Orlando. It was going to be, you know, and there was going to be one in Wisconsin, too. And these were going to be like programs that would really, you know, they'd create jobs. They would be displaying new technology, be opportunities for American companies to start up and provide. But Rick Scott down in Florida said, no, we don't want that money. And Scott Walker up in Wisconsin said, no, we don't want that money because the Republicans don't want there to be jobs going up to the presidential election. And you know, 30 years of Reaganomics and insane trade policies has left us here now with the two companies who are bidding to make train cars for San Francisco being French and Canadian. And the American company is out of business. We started the railroad revolution. The Baltimore and Ohio, the B&O, as I recall, was the first major U.S. railroad, and arguably one of the first in the world. In the steam revolution in the mid to late, well, in the mid 19th century. Incredible. And finally, obesity in the United States. It is costing us a lot. It's estimated that it's adding $190 billion to our medical tabs, costing businesses $30 billion in lost productivity. Obesity has tripled since 1960. And according to studies done by the Equality Trust in the UK and documented in Richard Wilkerson and Kate Pickett's book, The Spirit Level, and their previous book, Why Equal Societies Do Better, the more unequal a society is, in other words, the richer the rich are and the poorer are, and the less there is in the middle, the less of a middle class, the more obesity you have. Yes, obesity tracks inequality. And it has tripled since Reagan became president, as has inequality. Surprise, surprise. So, anyhow, your thoughts on all this. Bill in Denver, Colorado, listening on AM 760. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, I wanted to thank you very much for saying what I haven't heard anybody else say, is that this Supreme Court could even threaten Brown versus Board of Education. I don't think anybody under our age is really aware of the history that these Republicans, this conservative leadership, is the ideological descendants of the old Dixiecrat segregationists in the Confederate South.
Well, this is the Lochner. They're halfway to being the Lochner Court. The court back in the 1920s that was overturning child labor laws.
Sure. These people resented Brown versus Board of Education, resented the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act. They defected from the Democratic Party to the Republicans after LBJ signed those things. And
that's right.
It's rankled them ever since. They would love to overturn them, and this is their chance to do it. And I wish more people were aware of that history. There's a talking point on right-wing radio that they say, oh, Boris, the Republicans are the Civil Rights Party because more of them voted for the Civil Rights Act than Democrats did. But what they're not telling people is that there were basically two different Democratic parties back then, the Northern liberals and moderates, and then the Southern segregationist Dixiecrats, and they all both.
Well, and there was also a schism in the Republican Party. There were groups in the Republican Party was trying to make inroads in the South. The South had been solidly Democratic up until that point, up until the 60s. And
yeah.
there were Republicans who were trying, you know, Nixon. I mean, this was, you know, before LBJ, the Southern Strategy, right? It was a decade before this. Actually, it was afterwards, wasn't it, Nixon's? In any case, yeah. Nixon's Southern Strategy was all about having Republicans reach out to those right-wing, white, racist Southerners who had identified themselves as Democrats and turn them into Republicans. And guess what? That's our modern Republican Party, or a significant fraction of it.
And you're a JFK assassination buff. That was why JFK went to Dallas, was trying to reunite those two divergent wings of the Democratic Party. And then, of course, after LBJ signed those acts, they all left for the GOP.
Yeah, there you go. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Lucy in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on AM 950. Hey, Lucy, what's on your mind today?
Nathy?
Lacey? Oh, I'm sorry, Lacey. Yes.
That's okay. It's Nathy, but that's okay.
Nathy?
I'm in awe of being on the air with you. I just think you're the best.
Well, thank you. I just need to get stronger reading glasses.
It's okay. No, everybody, every call-in show messes up my name because it's unique, so I have a problem with it. Tom, I wanted to call because I'm piggybacking on a call that you had last week. I couldn't get in. Claire from Minneapolis called, and she talked to you about public funding for pro sports stadiums.
Yes.
And you had told her that we needed to start talking to our elected officials, starting with the CM, the council members, the mayor, and up the chain.
Yes.
I need you to know that these people are dinos. They're Democrats in name only, and R.T. Ryback has been leading the charge for the stadium. Between working for the Obama campaign and pushing the stadium, I don't know how he gets anything else done.
Yeah, I'm not sure that, you know, funding stadiums is so much a Democratic or Republican issue, you know, these days. Certainly,
I know,
you know,
it's not.
The problem is that A, sports are actually more popular than politics. There are more stations around the country carrying sports programming than political programming. More people listening to them and watching them. And so you've got people who, you know, this is a national pastime. And, you know, it used to be baseball. Now increasingly it's football and basketball. But, you know, sports is a big deal. And people somehow think, you know, the billionaires who own these teams have basically managed to convince people that, well, if A, that it's in their benefit for the team to be in town, and B, they've threatened them, they've blackmailed them, they've said, well, if you don't want to build a new stadium for us, we'll go someplace where they will. And this brings me back to Bernie Sanders' suggestion a couple of years ago that I still think is brilliant, that any community that participates in basically a blackmail operation by a corporation, and even a sports corporation, right? Any community that allows itself to be pitted off against another community and starts, you know, saying, oh, we'll give you tax breaks, we'll build you a stadium, we'll build you a factory, we'll give you free land, whatever it may be, and this is whether it's sports or manufacturing or retail, any community that does that, their state should lose their federal highway funds. And that would put an end to this practice. You wouldn't have to pass a law ending the practice. You could simply, you know, that would just bring it to a screeching halt. And at that point, the billionaires would have to build their own damn stadiums, and we'd all be the better for it. But, you know, Lacey, thanks for the heads up. I get it. I think that the issue is even larger and more systemic, and we need to be dealing with it. Jim in Chicago, listening to WCTP. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I heard rumblings last week of a woman that was running the GSA, who was a holdover from the Bush administration.
Yeah.
Something about a ton of appointed positions are now permanent.
Several thousand appointed positions were made into permanent bureaucratic positions in the final months of the Bush administration, and so Obama's basically stuck with a lot of these people. Yeah,
right. And I'm sure Think Progress or somebody's working on it to try to flush some of these out, some of these people out. They need to be outed.
Yeah, it would be a good idea. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim, and well said. And, only 30 seconds. I'm sorry. Not enough time to get another caller in here. But I did want to point out that Governor Rick Scott, the Republican down in Florida who never saw a bodily fluid, he didn't want to test. He actually made his millions as, you know, running a company that does lab testing on bodily fluids, drug testing. His let's drug test all the welfare recipients got knocked down by court. Now his let's drug test all 87,000 state employees. That just got knocked down by a federal judge saying that this is a violation of the Fourth Amendment, which says that you shall be secure in your person's property and papers, you know, in your person, unless you're actually, you know, somebody accuses you of a crime. So much for Governor Scott. I'm sure he'll continue. I just don't get it with these big government Republicans, you know, why they want to test everybody's bodily fluids.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But they do. And by the way, John Boehner is talking about how anybody who doesn't vote for Mitt Romney is voting for a loser. Huh?
Down the windows with the radio loud. Come on, turn it up. Yeah. Start living your life on the double. Leave your troubles behind. You and me.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And Marie in La Mesa, California. Hey, Marie, thanks for listening online. What's up?
Oh, it's my pleasure to be on the air. I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Well, I have a question. I'm looking for an annotated book on the Constitution and particularly the Federalist Papers and wondered if you have any recommendations.
Wow. You can buy very cheaply because they're in public domain, just the Federalist Papers, probably for $5-6 in most bookstores. You would have to, as you read them though, there's a lot of context that's missing, you know, and all the backstories and things like that. I don't off the top of my head know of a good book. Where I would start and the guy that I would ask is Harvey Kay. Harvey Kay is, in my opinion, one of America's best historians, particularly of that era. And he wrote a book called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, which isn't just about Thomas Paine. It's about the arc of that era, of the revolutionary era in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And it includes some discussion of the Federalist Papers, and you know, it gives you a lot of the backstory that would help you understand what you're reading when you're reading the Federalist Papers. And Harvey is quite accessible. He has a website. You can Google his name. It's Harvey, K-A-Y-E. And I think that, well, I don't want to say what his website is because, frankly, I don't know. And if I say it wrong, it'll, you know. But you can Google him very easily. And his email address is there. And or there's a way to contact him there, and he answers, he responds. So I would ask him the question, you know, what book would you recommend? If I had him on the air right now, I'd ask him that question. But before you do, I strongly recommend you read his book, Harvey Kay's book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, because it is absolutely, in my opinion, if not the best, certainly one of the best histories that has ever been written about the American Revolutionary Era. Okay.
Yes, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call. Jeff in Chicago. Hey, Jeff, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, I had a question about your book, Unequal Protection.
Yes, sir.
You've mentioned how you've gone to law schools occasionally to talk about it. And
yes.
I'm wondering, how is it going and in terms of penetrating law school students, and what is it going to take for future lawyers to for this to become common knowledge for them?
It's a damn good question. When the book was first published back in 2001 or 2002, I started writing it in 99. But, you know, it takes a year or so for books to get out. And I did a book tour, and part of it was I spoke at the Vermont Law School. I spoke at Lewis and Clark Law School out in Oregon, and there were a couple of others that I've now lost the names of, but I remember those in particular. And my first question would be, I remember at the Vermont Law School, there was like, I think about 300 people who showed up, mostly law students. There were a few professors, and a couple, you know, just curious people, but pretty much everybody who was into the law, because this was at that time an obscure topic, corporate personhood. And so anyhow, I said, how many of you know that in 1886 in the Supreme Court decision, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, raise your hand if you know that the Supreme Court in that decision granted corporations the rights of persons under the Constitution. Everybody in the room raised their hand, or virtually everybody. And, of course, by the time I was done, an hour and a half later, nobody would have raised their hand. But that was not only conventional wisdom, but it was what they were teaching in law schools all across the country. And so what has happened since the Citizens United decision? Is that first of all, the sales of my book on equal protection have gone from, you know, relatively small to quite large. I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but and it's because people have been awakened by the Supreme Court. I mean, this overreach by the Supreme Court. So I think actually the conventional wisdom thing is turning itself upside down. What is happening is lawyers, law students, law professors are starting to realize that A, the court didn't make that decision in 1886, although it did in subsequent years, and it pointed to a headnote in 1886 for the basis of that, and B, that the whole thing about you know, corporate personhood really went on steroids after the early 70s when Lewis Powell was put on the court. Lewis Powell, who wrote the famous memo to his friend, the president of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, about that led to the creation of the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute and all these other things, that, you know, the right needed to build an infrastructure. They needed to take over the courts. They needed to take over our schools, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the people are starting to wake up to that now. And you know, that's, in my mind, that's a good thing. So we'll see how this shakes out, but I think that we now have an awakened populace on this issue, and that makes me very optimistic. Make sense?
Yeah, it's good to hear.
Okay, thanks.
Permeating the legal profession some too, I think.
Yeah, there you go. And now the next challenge, and thanks for the call, Jeff. The next challenge is convincing the legal profession that Marbury versus Madison was wrongly decided. That's a whole other rant. Bill in Hoffman Estates, Illinois. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hi, good to talk to you. I'm pulling for your wife, my man.
She's here today. She's doing great. She's recovering very well from her surgery.
Okay. I got an argument with my sons. They're all right wingers. So I got in a conflict with them yesterday, or a debate, we'll call it. And the question that I'm bringing back to you is, I don't know how long ago, but you suggest, I think you stated over the, on the radio show that at the end of the Bush administration, the national debt was something in the neighborhood of $14 or $15 trillion. Is that?
No, I think it was in the neighborhood of around 10.
Oh, it's about $10 trillion.
I think it's pushing 13 now.
I heard it wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, but the second thing is, he says that just in the 3 years that Obama has been president, the debt is now $15 trillion. What's supporting that kind of statement from him? Well, who's he listening to, or has he got...
Who's the he that you're referring to?
This person is my son.
Oh. Yeah, well, it depends on... You know, he's not all that far off. I mean, the debt will be that once these budgets work their way out. And I'm not sure exactly what it is right now. You can probably Google it and look it up fairly easily. But the fact of the matter is that just as Eisenhower borrowed money to get us out of the debt from World War II, frankly, Obama needs to be borrowing money to get us out of this disaster.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Phil Kirpin, AmericanCommitment.org. Phil, this is the president of American Commitment and author of Democracy Denied. Is American Commitment a new organization, Phil?
Brand new, Tom. We just launched 2 weeks ago.
You used to be with, refresh my memory.
I was with Americans for Prosperity for about 5.5 years.
That's what I thought. I didn't want to blurt out the wrong one, but... Okay, well, good luck on your new adventure here. Why do conservatives support bankrupting our kids? We've got $1 trillion in debt in this country, in student loan debt in this country, and virtually every other, you know, fully developed democracy in the world allows students who are competent to go to college or trade school to do so for free. Some, in many of these countries, they even pay for it. We did here in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. It was free, and if you were a veteran, you actually got a stipend. It's how my dad went to college. It's how Louise's dad became a lawyer and became the assistant attorney general for the state of Michigan. Wouldn't have been able to without that. Why are you guys so opposed to that?
Well, not so much that we're opposed to that. I mean, I think that higher education should be accessible and affordable, but I think that government subsidies have created the opposite, because you've got an industry with very high barriers to entry through the accreditation process and all of the other associated startup costs and so on. So you have very few new colleges and universities being started and formed and being taken seriously. And so when you've got very tight constraints on supply and you start to massively subsidize demand by piling on more and more taxpayer dollars, subsidized below market loans, grants, and so on, it's all flowed into higher tuition.
Phil, you're saying that up is down.
Affordable. I'm telling you what's happened over the past couple of days.
No, you're literally saying that up is down, that black is white.
Phil, an industry with relatively fixed supply. When you artificially boost demand with relatively fixed supply, you get much higher prices. And that's
okay, so why is it then? If what you're saying is true, Phil, hey, let me ask you a question, would you? If what you're saying is true, then why is it that in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, when college was free in most of the United States, and in fact, when people got paid to go to college, my dad got a $100 a month stipend to go to college, and you know, as a returning GI after World War II, why is it that college at that time didn't explode in cost? Because you had massive government subsidies at that time. And now we have actually much lower government subsidies. Now you've got the students paying for it. They've borrowed $1 trillion to pay for this. You know, it's the exact opposite of what you're saying.
Well, there was much less demand there, Tom, because most people didn't aspire to college. Most people weren't directed to a college career track. You had a very different kind of structure of the economy overall. You had very many, many fewer people who desired those slots. It was a very different environment. But I'm talking about really what's happened since 1980 or so, where we've seen this massive explosion in tuition costs that coincided with
Reagan's presidency.
Coincided with a huge increase in subsidies.
In what?
Subsidies. Grants and loans.
So why is it that every other country in the world that sends their kids to college for free doesn't have this problem?
Well, you know, I don't know what country you're talking about or what would be common.
Well, how about Germany? How about Denmark? How about Sweden? I've been in those countries. I gave a speech in Sweden to a group of educators just a couple weeks ago.
They track people from a very young age for vocational training, and so sort of as a percentage of the population, they have far fewer people who are aspiring to a university-type education.
Well, an awful lot of these student loans, Phil, as you well know, are not university educations. They're trade schools. In fact, the biggest explosion of them has been these for-profit groups that say, you know, we'll teach you how to be an electronics technician or a typist or a key punch operator. That's anachronistic, but the equivalent, you know, a data entry person. We'll prepare you and then there's no job when they get it, but they're stuck with, you know, a relatively useless diploma from a for-profit college and $20,000 in debt.
Yeah, a lot of those guys are scamming the system. I would agree with you 100%. You've got a lot of people right now that are setting up what they call colleges, but really it's, you know, little to do with anything except kind of getting a piece of all the government subsidized
money, and
students end up with these debt loads coming out of it.
I'm glad we have a point of agreement, but I'm still confused about how is it that if the argument that conservatives are making is that when government subsidizes education, the price of education goes up, why is it that when the government was heavily subsidizing education back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and early 70s, the price of education was really, really low? In the late 60s, early 70s, my wife worked her way through college as a waitress at a Howard Johnson's part-time. I worked my way through college to the extent that I didn't graduate, but when I went to college as a DJ, as a, you know, flipping burgers and changing tires in a gas station. You could do that back then. Now you can't. And in every country around the world where they subsidize college educations, and, you know, anybody who wants to go to college who's qualified can for free. And in some cases, like in Denmark, they actually pay you a couple hundred dollars a month to help, you know, with your expenses. Why they're not experiencing the same explosion in debt and tuition? It seems to me like the banksters and the for-profit colleges have gotten together and figured out a new way to squeeze a new generation of Americans. And they're having a great time doing it. They're making a fortune. And I don't understand why anybody who calls themselves a conservative would think that that was a good thing.
Well, first of all, the not-for-profit colleges, the traditional universities, are running pretty much the same scam. But I think, you know, you look, a lot of them have vast land holdings, vast commercial dealings. They're charging huge tuitions. They're building up endowments that don't pay off for anything. So the idea that it's just for-profit that benefits.
I don't disagree with that. We've got a system that has gone kaflooey, and it's gone kaflooey in large part since, you know, Ronald Reagan came in, put Bill Bennett in charge, who had previously campaigned on a platform of ending the Department of Education, put him in charge of the Department of Education, started basically deregulating universities, changing the way that help went to universities, and now we've got billionaires stepping in. Now you've got the Koch brothers funding, what, over 100 different chairs at universities around the country where you have to read Ayn Rand and they get to fire professors that they don't like? I mean, this is bizarre.
Well, Tom, I think to go back to your example, I think that the tuitions were much more contained in the 60s and 70s, not because there were more government subsidies, but because there was a lot less. I mean,
no, but they're contained right now in every other country.
And when students are paying their own tuition bill, you can only charge so much if you want to sign up students. Instead, you bring in these financial intermediaries who've got access to, you know, more or less unlimited debt financing. And suddenly there's no constraint on what you can get away with charging, and that's the problem that we have.
So let's get some constraints on that. That's called government regulation.
Well, you know, I have a very different philosophy from you. I would prefer to see market restraint and a market allocation of resources.
So we just want these billionaires to be nice people.
All these subsidies.
So how would you solve this problem, Phil, of $1 trillion in student debt, an entire generation wiped out, and it becoming increasingly impossible for anybody who isn't a member of the Lucky Sperm Club to go to college?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would suggest that for a lot of people, there are roads to redemption in American life that don't run through a schoolhouse. You mentioned that you're not a college graduate. I'm not either. I've done quite fine for myself, as you have. I think that the idea that we tell our children there's no other way to succeed in this country is a disservice.
I think those days, though, have passed us by, Phil. You and I are a lot older than 20-year-olds, and these days, a 20-year-old in the job market, a BA is like a high school degree was 30 years ago.
But the question is whether it's worth, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 in debt. And for a lot of people, it's not. And they've got to...
Well, it's clearly not. I think the question is who should pay for it. But Phil, we're out of time. Thank you for dropping by. AmericanCommitment.org is Phil's new organization. Phil Kirpin. Good talking with you, Phil.
Thanks, Thomas.
15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Up next, Taking My Country Back. And, gee, that was one of the first times Phil didn't blow up and start yelling at me. New organization must be treating him well. We'll be right back.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like how you've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now
this song actually originally came out during the Bush administration, but I still love it. It's our Taking My Country Back segment, and where we're identifying people who are running for political office that are, you know, really good people doing really good work who are worthy of your support, and letting them introduce themselves to you. Today, Ron Barber's on the line. He's the former district director for Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who was hit by two bullets. Ron was hit by two bullets when Gabby Giffords was shot in January of 2011. His website is ronbarberforcongress.com, and it's spelled just the way you would think, B-A-R-B-E-R, and for Congress is spelled out F-O-R, so it's ronbarberforcongress.com is the website. And Ron, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you today.
Thank you. You were shot twice the day that Gabby Giffords was shot. You okay?
Yeah, I'm doing great. You know, it's been a recovery period with a lot of help from my family. My community has been awesome. The doctors, of course, were tremendous that day, attending to all of us, as were the citizen heroes, the people who came to our aid right away. So we were very fortunate. We had an amazing community support system, and I'm doing well. I wouldn't be in this race if I didn't think I was up to it. I'm fully energized, not only by getting in, but by seeing the support we've had so far.
That's great. And I'm really impressed that having seen probably the ugliest side of American politics, which is, you know, people running around with guns going after politicians, that you still have the courage and commitment to say, okay, I'm going to stand up and, you know, because Gabby Giffords is retiring, that you're going to run for that seat. So tell us, what's your platform? Why should our viewers and listeners go to Ron Barber for Congress, ronbarberforcongress.com, and pitch in, support, whether they be our listeners on KPHX in Phoenix or on Sirius XM in Phoenix or Free Speech TV, Dish or Direct in Phoenix or the other ways, or anywhere else in the country?
Well, let me just start by talking a little bit about my background and the experience that I will bring to this job. For over 30 years, I served as the regional administrator and the state director of an organization called the Division of Developmental Disabilities, and our goal was to help families stay together if they had a child with disabilities by providing supports at home, and trying to get people out of institutions and then back into their community so they could go to work and have real and full lives. And I'm very proud of that 32 years experience working, trying to solve problems for people who really wanted to have the government help them, not get in their way. So this was a very important time in my life, and public service is really one of the main things that I'm involved with and why I'm running for Congress. My wife and I also, during that time, she operated the business. We had a small business for 22 years. So I have experience in what it takes to run a business, to meet a payroll, keep the doors open. And then, as you mentioned, Tom, I spent 5.5 years working for Congresswoman Giffords. So another part of what I bring to the table for consideration by people in Southern Arizona is 5.5 years of experience with their issues, their concerns. And as I go across the district, I hear it over and over again. People say the middle class is disappearing. We play by the rules. People at the top of the economic bracket are getting ahead. We're not. Wages are stagnant. Jobs are hard to come by. When I get a job, I'm working underemployed because of my skills are much higher than the job. Foreclosures. Arizona's got one of the highest foreclosure rates in the country. We have to have policies in Washington. We have to have budgets in Washington that support middle-class Americans and don't just favor the top income bracket and corporations. Obviously, we want everyone to have to pay their fair share, and that's part of what I'm talking about in the campaign. The second important issue, because we have a very large population of seniors in our district, the second issue, of course, is protecting Social Security and Medicare. The budget that the House recently passed couldn't be worse for seniors. It takes away or would completely change Medicare, which is a lifeline that seniors should expect after they've paid in all their lives when they get to be retirement age, and the same with Social Security. My opponent has far different priorities, and I'd be happy to talk about those, but those are the reasons I'm running, to make sure that middle-class Americans get the support they need and be their champion in Congress.
Okay. And Ron Barber, your opponent, what would happen if your opponent got Gabby Gifford's seat, do you think?
Oh, let me drill down on the things that he has said that he believes in, and I'm sure he would carry them out if he was a member of Congress. He said that Social Security is a Ponzi scheme and it should be privatized. He said that Medicare puts people on the public dole, and he would like to see that eliminated and turned into a voucher system. He has said we need to eliminate the minimum wage. He's also said that we need to give a zero tax rate to corporations. The list goes on and on and on and on, issue after issue after issue. He and I couldn't disagree more. There's a big contrast between me and my opponent, who is very proud that he ran as a Tea Party candidate back in 2010 and is running again into that same kind of support. So we need all the help we can get to make sure that he cannot get elected and take the seat, which has been held so honorably by Congresswoman Giffords. So
this is the guy that Gabby Giffords ran against last time.
That's right. And just to make sure people know, it was a very close race. You know, he came within 1.4 percentage points of beating her. Only 4,200 votes separated them at the end.
Wow.
So I'm not taking anything for granted. This is going to be a very tough race. It's a Republican-leaning district. It has we expect a low turnout in the special election. Kelly came close before, and with his background and support from that time, he may well come on strong and probably.
So is this election not happening in November with the general election? This is a special election that's happening earlier?
Election, which is also a little confusing.
When is it happening?
June 12th is the general election for the special, and it's only 6 weeks away now, so we've got a lot of work to do.
Wow. Okay.
Why this race is so important.
Yeah, I'm sorry I missed that. I should have led with that. And so June 12th is the election that you're standing against this right-wing crazy, my words, not yours, to take Gabby Gifford's seat. And people can find out more. Ron Barber for forcongress.com. Check it out. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Tom, very much.
Good luck.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And we'll be back with Florida Governor. Oh, John Boehner. I got to tell you about this.
Oh, I want to get away. I fly away. Yeah.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. By the way, Aaron Schwartz is going to be with us at the top of the next hour. He's the founder and director of Demand Progress, contributing editor to the Baffler, about CISPA. We're really going to dig into this thing, this internet. You know, every corporation in America can snoop on you, piece of legislation that Republicans overwhelmingly supported in the House of Representatives, Democrats largely opposed. It now goes to the Senate. It is starting to get, and today Microsoft has come out and said, well, we're not sure that we still support this. So we'll see how that goes. With regard to taxes, Brilliant piece by Pat Buchheit over at commondreams.org. Five tax fallacies about the 1%. When you add up, you know, Rush Limbaugh likes to point out to the very rich pay 23% of their income in taxes, and the middle class don't pay so much. They pay about 8% in federal income taxes. But what he doesn't tell you is that while the rich, the very rich, pay only about 2% of their income in Social Security taxes, average working people pay about 10% of their income towards Social Security. And while the very rich pay only 7% of their income in state and sales tax and property and excise taxes, the middle class pays around 10%. So if you take the very rich's 23% federal tax plus 2% Social Security plus 7% state and local and subtract out the 3% that they're getting back, you end up with 29% that they're paying. If you take the average middle class person with their 8% federal income tax and their 10% Social Security and their 10% state sales, all those taxes, you get 28%. So they're almost identical, 28 or 29%. So much for the myth that the rich pay all the taxes, right? And it very much is a myth. James in Chicago. Hey, James, what's on your mind today?
Well, you were starting to talk about college costs earlier on in the show. And I'm thinking back to my college days in the 70s. When I was actually living in New York and went to Hofstra University, it was costing me $100 a credit for an 18-credit semester.
So $1,800.
$3,600 a year plus books.
And what, okay, $3,600 a year. Yeah, that's, what year was that?
That was in the late 70s.
Yeah. And I went back and looked at when my mom went to Michigan State University, which was in the 40s, and she was paying $242 a year, is my recollection.
And the neat thing is, when I graduated, I had zero debt.
Right, right, and which is typical of your generation, James, and of my parents' generation, and very atypical of my kids' generation, and thus the tragedy. Thanks for sharing your story with us, and you know, we need to do something about this, and we need to do something more than simply say, as conservatives are, or as what was it, Virginia Fox, the congresswoman the other day, I have very little tolerance for people to complain about, you know, or words to that effect. People who complain about the fact that they're in debt, when it turns out that she got like $50,000, some amazing amount of money from for-profit colleges who are just basically ripping people off. It's amazing. Dick in Harrisonburg, Virginia, watching us on Free Speech TV. Dick,
hey,
what's on
you got me.
Yeah.
Am I there?
You are. What's up?
There you go. Listen, I just came up with the answer to a large problem that has been addressed on the show towards education.
Mm-hmm.
What is wrong with free education TV? Can it be done?
Well, that's a good question. You know, there was a movement toward that back in the 50s and 60s. There were education.
There was a movement here. There was a movement here on TV back only 15 years ago when I used to be able to turn on my Dish Network, and I ended up getting some college shows.
Yeah.
Which I'd watch, and I could learn about sociology, different educational factors. This would give me a preamble to get a little extra education free.
Yeah, and there was bandwidth allocated for that back in the 50s and 60s, maybe even before that. I'm not really sure, but
so
you know,
it's
that
really up to, Tom, it's really up to you if you could just grab hold of that thought and run with it and ask that question: why can't we have TV or computers at home run educational systems? What would happen? The schools would be in an uproar. The whole country would be wondering, you know, can they educate? Yes, they can educate somebody through a computer. It's done every day, and through TV.
Well, the analogy to that, Dick. First of all, let me finish my thought. My earlier thought. There was an attempt to do that. Educational programming, NPR, and public broadcasting grew out of that. Community broadcasting grew out of that, and many colleges and schools had broadcasting systems, and in many cases they had those UHF channel TV signals, and you know that was happening in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and there were a lot of experimentation on that, and it really just didn't seem to go very far. Then now there are, of course, there are mail order schools. There are, anybody can read a textbook. I mean, why would it be, you know, any different watching it on TV or reading the textbook? In my mind, the thing that is missing from trying to get a college education on TV or reading textbooks, unless they're really, you know, it's a correspondence course or something that's really tailored to give you that education, is the whole gestalt, the whole experience of being with other people who are learning things, the Socratic technique, or, you know, experience of challenging new ideas and, or having your old ideas challenged and pushing back and having somebody push back at you and, you know, the dialogue, the give and take, the breaking of old patterns of thinking and the developing of new and, or vice versa. Those things I really believe are things that come out of a collective educational experience, and one in which you've got a small enough classroom that a professor or a teacher can actually interact with the students.
Homebound. So this, for me, would be an ideal situation.
Okay, if you're...
I know that, you know, you're saying you found the reasons why it couldn't be.
No, I'm not saying why it couldn't be. I'm saying why it wouldn't be superior to or even equal to a regular college education. But for somebody who's homebound like yourself... Yeah, you know, it's I think that you would be surprised how many colleges are putting coursework up on the web and putting professors' lectures on the web. I haven't done a search on it recently, but I can tell you.
To, yes, it's being done. This is how you go about doing it.
Yeah, I know it can be. Well, thank you, Dick. Thank you very much. And I know this can be done. I mean, and I know that it's possible to do that. One of our kids who's sitting in the studio with us right now. Who came down to visit to help out when her mom was going through breast cancer surgery, actually homeschooled through an online school. It was called Oak Meadow, oakmeadow.com, I'm pretty sure. Was that the URL? Oakmeadow.org? Yeah. Anyhow, so the school is Oak Meadow, and you know, you can go to high school. This was high school. And, you know, she was quite successful with that. So, Marcia in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Marcia, what's up? Marcia?
I wanted to say something to the guy that the liberal that has two conservative sons that you were talking to earlier. But I want to ask you something when I'm finished, so let me hurry up and do it.
Sure.
What he should say to them is that, yes, the government has screwed up, and the $10 trillion in debt was caused by both Republicans and Democrats, but the reason he needs to make sure they understand the reason is because the businesses and the corporations had their money hooks into the legislators. They give them, you know, all kinds of money and perks, and there's lots of things he can have them sit down and watch Inside Story with him and see how many legislators have their, you know, are donating money to have people vote their way.
Yeah. Well, let me just give you a very quick example, if I may. In the 1950s, during the Republican Eisenhower administration, for every dollar that a worker paid in payroll taxes, a corporation paid $3 in taxes. Right? Corporations, for every dollar that a worker paid in payroll taxes, corporation paid $3 in corporate income taxes. Today,
right, not,
for every dollar a worker, let me finish this thought. Today, for every dollar that a worker pays in payroll taxes, a corporation pays 22 cents. So we've gone from $3 to 22 cents from the 1950s to today, which is your point, I believe. There's a statistic to back it up.
I was talking about the hundreds of thousands of dollars that are donated to legislators.
Certainly.
This is
because they've been buying tax breaks. We have a minute to the break. You had a question.
Okay. All right. Well, see, my question is for you. I started something on Facebook called the Equal Access Amendment Project, which covers trying to fix the voting rules, and it covers more than just Citizens United. It covers ballot access. It covers the voting tools like the paper ballot, et cetera, et cetera. I know you're very busy, but would you drop by and take a look at it and give me whatever kind of help you could
Post a note about it on Tom's blog on our homepage at tomhartman.com. That's the one that I'm pretty religious about reading.
All right. If anybody else wants to help write it, jump in now.
Okay, what's your website?
It's a Facebook.
Oh, it's a Facebook page.
Equal Access Amendment Project.
Okay, great. Marcia, right. we'll check it out. Thank you very much for the call. And you know, what Marcia's doing is what so many of us need to be doing. I mean, you know, I'm not vouching for what she's done. I haven't seen it. But no matter how brilliant or not it might be, it's like she's doing something. And it always amazes me. People who call up and go, you know, the politicians, have you done anything? No, I just complain. No, you got to do something. You got to get active.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We're probably going to check in with the Talk Radio News Service coming up shortly and be taking more of your calls as the program. Balance. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Victoria Jones is with us with the Talk Radio News Service. And Victoria, greetings.
Thank you very much.
You know, it was really nice seeing you. In fact, sitting at the table with you at the White House Correspondents' Dinner Saturday night. And that was a hoot. I haven't even mentioned on the air that I went to that thing. That was wild. It was a wild evening. But
well, we all enjoyed it, except Representative Alan West, who went and ate and drank and had a good time with everybody. Mm-hmm. And I saw him in the corridors having a good time.
So did I.
Took to Facebook today to say, well, the president laughs and dines. Our constitutional republic is eroding and my countrymen are suffering.
Except that he was walking around in a tuxedo with an entourage.
Yes, in this election year, it is sad to think that some of those who were sitting in that ballroom Saturday night laughing and living it up are helping to perpetuate the manipulation and deception of our country. And he also noted that he walked from the event in the rain to catch the metro back to the Batcave.
Ah, back to the Batcave.
I mean, what is this?
Amazing, amazing. Well, many of us walked back to the metro. I didn't this year. I did last year. This year, you know, we went over to Ellen's party afterwards and hung out long enough that it was possible to get a cab again. But, you know, it was impossible to get a taxi after that thing. So, you know, I doubt he was making a statement of we the people.
It's just bizarre. He ate his dinner.
He did. So what's going on in the real world of news?
Well, with regard to Chinese blind activist dissident lawyer Chen Guancheng,
yes,
who escaped from house arrest last week and is believed to be on the U.S. embassy compound somewhere, the U.S. diplomats have met with officials at the Chinese Foreign Ministry to try to hammer out some kind of agreement about what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to do this and get an agreement before Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner arrive there on Wednesday for high-level talks with China's leadership on completely separate issues.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be very awkward.
Awkward. Very awkward. So what it's looking like, according to Bob Fu, who's a U.S.-based activist with China Aid, who says he helped Chen escape house arrest, is it's looking much more likely that he would come to the U.S. For what they call medical treatment.
Oh, interesting.
Now, Chen originally said that he did not want to leave China. He wants to stay in China and fight for human rights. He didn't want to come to the U.S. But there's a great difficulty in guaranteeing his safety inside China, they're saying. So that making departure for the U.S. is a more attractive option for both American and Chinese officials.
Now, what are the topics that the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Treasury are going to be discussing with the Chinese?
These are annual talks, so they're largely major economic issues,
mm-hmm,
and security issues.
Interesting. Is the issue, have there been any, you know, early trial balloons, for example, currency manipulation? That seems
will
to be
come up.
Yeah.
That will definitely come up. In fact, Tim Geithner spoke about that last week.
Right.
And said that he is going to raise the issue.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
So what else is up?
Well, very interesting. The Prime Minister of Japan is in Washington, D.C. to meet with President Obama today. They had a joint press availability this afternoon. And the president was asked a question about Mitt Romney's statements that basically that anybody would have made the call to go and get bin Laden, including Jimmy Carter, who actually made quite a courageous call that went wrong. But nevertheless, anybody would have given that order. And it's dismissing questions by Obama's re-election campaign about whether Romney would have issued the same command, and it seems now to be saying that of course he would, when in fact he's on record as having said the opposite.
Well, and in fact, George W. Bush had an opportunity to take out bin Laden, or they didn't know if bin Laden was with the group. They thought he might be, but there was a high-powered, high-level group of al-Qaeda folks in Pakistan, and Bush passed on it. That's a matter of public record. He said no, and he probably would have gotten bin Laden if he had said yes, but he didn't want to upset General Pervez Musharraf. The at that time military dictator of Pakistan didn't want to upset the relationship there, or he was afraid that he'd have a Jimmy Carter experience. Carter, some would argue that one of the reasons why Carter lost the White House to Reagan was because he tried to rescue the hostages and failed.
Exactly.
That helicopter crashed
so
in the desert.
For Romney to make this statement is very interesting, because it was actually a very risky decision for Obama to make.
Yeah,
and he was restating that and giving that Carter analogy unbeknownst to himself.
Very interesting.
So Obama addressed this in the press conference. He said, as far as my personal role and what other folks would do, I just recommend that everybody take a look at people's previous statements in terms of whether they thought it was appropriate to go into Pakistan and take out bin Laden. I assume that people meant what they said when they said it. That's been at least my practice. I said that I'd go after bin Laden if we had a clear shot at him, and I did. If there are others who have said one thing and now suggest they do something else, then I'd go ahead and let them explain it.
Very interesting. You know, one of the head advisors or surrogates or whatever for the Romney campaign is now coming out and saying that the reason why the U.S. auto industry has been saved is because Obama followed Romney's advice?
Yes, Eric Fernstrom, the Etch-a-Sketch man.
How do these guys think... here's the question, I guess. Are they going to get away with these just bald-faced lies? Are the American people going to buy this?
I think they'll get away with some of them, but not all of them.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Some, but not all.
Yeah. Okay. I think we got about 40 seconds. A few other stories?
The president spoke to the AFL-CIO today and slammed John Boehner and the House Republican leadership for the second time in a week. Today it was over construction projects, saying that the Republicans have been refusing to take up the long-term highway bill approved in the bipartisan vote in the Senate.
Okay, great. Victoria Jones from the basement of the White House. Her very own cubicle there, or cubby, or broom closet, or...
Yeah.
Suite. Excuse me. Luxury suite.
Yeah.
There we go. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
As always, great talking with you. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Aaron Schwartz on the line with DemandProgress.org. First it was SOPA, then it was PIPA, now it's what? Aaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us. And first of all, give us a quick recap of how we went from SOPA and PIPA to this new grotesque piece of legislation, CISPA.
Well, so... as your listeners may remember, SOPA and PIPA were these bills that would allow the government to censor websites on the Internet. And they were pushed by the entertainment industry, especially by Hollywood, in order to allow them to shut down sites that had copyrighted music and movies and, you know, who knows what else they wanted to shut down. And so that was soundly defeated thanks to an enormous outcry of people all over the internet and progressive activists. And now we're seeing a similar kind of bill, but not from Hollywood, but this time it's from the Pentagon. And instead of just letting the government censor the internet, the idea behind the bill is to allow the government to spy on the internet as well. So basically, the military will be given control over key portions of the internet and will be allowed to access all sorts of personal, private information without going through the normal privacy safeguards.
Well, and not only that, they get to partner with corporate America in doing this, and corporate America doesn't ever inform us of what's going on, if my understanding of this is correct.
Yeah, I mean, I've been calling it a Patriot Act for the internet, because what it does is, again, like the Patriot Act, it allows the government, without a warrant, without any sort of normal due process, to go to these corporations and get this data that would normally be private, confidential data, without informing you, without any of the normal safeguards you would have, and then there are no restrictions on how it can be used, and if it's used improperly, they're immunized, so you can't even sue them after the fact.
Yeah, when the original Patriot Act was passed, one of the big outcries was that if government officials showed up at the library and asked a librarian what books you had been checking out, A, they had to tell the government, but B, if they told you that they had reported you to the government or the government had been inquiring about you, they could go to jail. And there were librarians all over this country who were signing petitions. It became a big deal. It was a story everybody could understand and identify with. This is that on steroids, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about how revealing the books you check out from the library are, now think about how revealing everything you search for on Google is. I mean, you know, visit every web page that you visit, every email that you send. This is just an incredible level of personal data that the government would have access to without you even knowing that they have access to it.
Well, and even frankly, from my point of view, I mean, I am concerned about overly large government, although I realize that's a right-wing frame, but I'm concerned about a national security state that diminishes our liberties. Let's just say that bluntly. But I'm also concerned about, you know, what was experienced during Mussolini's time, which was basically corporate rule, the merger of corporate and state interests. And if the government says to Microsoft or whatever, I mean, we'd like to know what's going on with Aaron Schwartz, and that company then does the whole scrub thing and gets all your information and hands it off to the government. Now that they've got your information, my understanding is that now that they've been empowered to get your information, they can continue to use that information. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I mean, that's right. You know, the military-industrial complex is not a left-wing fear. I mean, it goes back to Eisenhower. And this is sort of the military-industrial complex on steroids, as you might say. What it does is now it's not just, you know, the government and military contractors conspiring, but they're allowed to bring in Facebook and Google and all these tech companies into the loop and share information between, you know, the NSA, the CIA, various government agencies, Facebook, Google, all of them will be allowed to pool the data they have on people.
Which could be used for marketing purposes as well as for security purposes, or am I misreading this?
No, I think that's right. You know, I think people have been wondering, why have companies like Facebook been lobbying in favor of this bill when they lobbied so hard against things like SOPA? And I think the answer is pretty obvious. These companies like Google and Facebook and Microsoft, they make money off of selling people's privacy. They make money off of taking people's personal data and selling it to companies to target ads and mailers and so on. And so it's no surprise that a bill that makes it easier and, you know, removes the risks from doing that.
Well, and in fact, my understanding is that this bill makes it impossible for you to sue.
Yeah,
do I have that right?
That's right. That's one of the most amazing provisions, is it immunizes the companies so that there's no lawsuit you can bring against them for violating your privacy. I mean, there's actually a line in the bill that says it overrides every other privacy protection in every other law. I mean, it's just amazing.
Well, and every other law would presumably include the law of laws, the Constitution, the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, I mean, there's none of this sort of due process provisions that the Constitution requires in this bill. And I, you know, I mean, maybe it will be subject to a constitutional challenge, but the fact that the government is even considering throwing away all of the protections that have been built up, the constitutional protections courts have said we require, is stunning to me.
Right, and then not only can you not sue either the government or these corporations for spying on you and snooping on you and then selling the information to each other and making money off it and or just sitting around and giggling about it, whatever they want. Not only can you not do that, but if, you know, traditionally, you know, I was active in SDS back in the 60s and 70s, and we were ultimately able to sue the Michigan State Police and get our files, you know, Freedom of Information Act, and find out who the infiltrators were and what people were up to and things. My understanding is that this bill explicitly or specifically exempts both the government and these corporations from Freedom of Information Act filings.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where they, you know, again, it's a lot like the Patriot Act, where they say, oh, it's national security. You know, we have to protect against cyber terrorists. And so we couldn't possibly disclose to the public what we've learned about them because, you know, they might use it for more terrorism or something. I mean, it's the usual sort of excuse. But again, it's a way to get this ridiculous, unchecked, unaccountable power.
This is extraordinary. Who brought this bill forward? Where did this come from?
It's been introduced by Mike Rogers in the House, a Republican, and by, surprise, surprise, Senator Lieberman in the Senate.
Oh, my. And so far, is the support or opposition for this bill, I know it passed the House last week, and it was about a 50-50 vote, or, you know, close to a 47, something like that. How did that break out along party lines?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I think this is one of these things where Democrats and Republicans both have claimed to agree with the bill's aims. So, for example, you know, Senator Lieberman's bill and the Democratic co-sponsors he has are his bill is very similar to the bill that the Republicans have been pushing in the House.
Right.
And so when you look at those vote breakdowns, they're not quite about the bill itself. They're not about the substance of the bill. They're, in fact, about, you know, okay, the Republicans want it slightly different. Like, the Republicans want the Pentagon to have control over it, and the Democrats want the Department of Homeland Security to have control over it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, like, it's an important difference. It would be better if the Pentagon didn't have control over the Internet. But it's pretty subtle compared to the fact that the government is trying to spy on people at all.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And so it now Microsoft, I understand today, has taken a tentative step backwards from this.
Yeah, I mean, we're starting to see the beginnings of people pulling back. So Microsoft issued a statement, and, you know, a couple days ago, in a pretty shocking move, the White House issued a veto threat, which, you know, for this White House to oppose a bill because it trampled on privacy too much is pretty surprising. But yeah. I think it shows exactly how extreme this bill is.
Eric Schwartz, founder and director of Demand Progress, contributing editor to The Baffler, demandprogress.org, the website. Aaron, thanks for the whole scoop here.
Thanks for having me.
I appreciate it. And it's all about CISPA, C-I-S-P-A, this insane piece of, in my opinion, piece of legislation. Contact your member of Congress and let them know what you think.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And back to, I got to tell you, is the United States the most taxed country in the world?
They just like monsters. They come to feed on others.
Did you know that during the Great Depression in the 1930s, the unemployment rate in Spain hit 23%? That's how bad it got. Here in the United States, it was in the low 30s, 33-34%, about 1 in 3 Americans. It was about 1 in 4 Spaniards, 23%. You know what it is right now? 24.5%. This is the result of Spain being forced to do this whole austerity thing that the banksters are shoving down the throats of European governments that got burned when the banking crash happened. And so the banksters, they crashed the economy, and then they forced this austerity, this trickle-down austerity on these countries, and say, oh, you've got to make your government smaller, you got to shrink it, you got to end your government benefits. And what it does, of course, is it throws the country into a worse recession, and into depression. Tens of thousands of Spaniards were in the streets today. They were in the streets yesterday, and tomorrow is May Day. They're going to be in the streets tomorrow. They're saying, no, Half of all people under 25 years old in Spain are unemployed right now. I mean, that's how bad it is. So just to give you a heads up, you know, and tomorrow is International Workers' Day. And again, we've got these technocrats and banksters all over the country, all over the world. You got them here in the United States, of course, Paul Ryan and his budget. Let's slash everything. This is the Republican mantra here, or the conservative mantra, I should say. There are some Democrats who signed up for it as well. And but by and large, this is the Republican shtick. Internationally, it's just incredibly destructive. Meanwhile, Speaker John Boehner says people who aren't worth hundreds of millions of dollars, like Mitt Romney, are losers, his phrase. I thought this was really quite extraordinary. Here it is. If you can play the audio out of my computer here.
Someone who is as wealthy as he is, who had as much privilege as he is, has a hill to climb to overcome that.
No. American people don't want to vote for a loser. They don't want to vote for someone that hasn't been successful.
There you go. So they want to vote for the guy who's worth a quarter of $1 billion. You know, after all, he made it by stripping and companies and firing people and laying them off and sending their jobs over. Say, well, we can etch-a-sketch that out. We'll paint that out. But it raises the question. If your definition of success is being worth a couple hundred million dollars, does John Boehner and do his buddies think that somebody who was a community organizer is not successful? I mean, is that the implicit message? Or that a teacher who's not worth millions is not successful? I think the American people want to vote for somebody who is going to behave in their interest. The American people want to vote for somebody who cares about what's going on in this country. The American people want to vote for somebody who can understand their needs. This is one of the problems that I think that Mitt Romney has and will continue to have. And that is that he is the guy who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Obama the other day said, I wasn't born with a silver spoon in my mouth. You know, I had to get college loans to go to college. He was talking about him and Michelle. And in fact, he didn't pay off his student loans until he was a senator. You know, when he was running for president, it was about the time he was able to finally, you know, because of his book sales, was able to make enough money to pay off his student loans. But the fact of the matter is that he wasn't born with a silver spoon in his mouth, and we elected him. On the other hand, Jack Kennedy was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, and he was not an unreasonable president. Franklin Roosevelt's probably an even better example, very, very wealthy man. So I don't think, frankly, that the American people care one way or another. I don't think that, you know, where somebody came from is going to be a criteria. And that cuts both ways. I don't think Romney's wealth is going to hurt him. Bill Clinton ran on, you know, he was the poor kid from Hope, Arkansas, whose father died, you know, when he was little. And in fact, I think before he was born and all that sort of thing. But he ran on being kind of come up through the ranks success story. But it was in government, which would be ridiculed today. And actually was during that campaign. But I think that the American people, when it gets right down to it, they set all that stuff aside. And what they really pay attention to, what they're really thinking about, what they're really concerned about, is the policies. You know, they get it that the country has been driven into a ditch by 30 years of Reaganomics. I mean, just consider this. 31 years of Reaganomics, of tax cuts for the millionaires and billionaires. The average corporation before Reagan, for every $1 that a worker paid in payroll taxes, the average corporation was paying $3 in corporate income taxes. Now they're paying 30-some-odd cents. I mean, it's just this incredible collapse. It is breathtaking, the collapse that we have seen in the American middle class as a consequence of Reaganomics. And then on top of that, the insane trade policies that were promoted by Ronald Reagan, were promoted by George Herbert Walker Bush, I think are now regretted by Bill Clinton and have been promoted by and were aggressively, amped up so much by George W. Bush that we lost 50,000 factories just during his presidency. Not jobs, factories. I started out the program earlier talking about how, you know, a French company and a Canadian company are bidding to build the new train cars for BART, for the Bay Area Rapid Transit System, for the San Francisco subways. A Canadian company and a French company? There are no American companies left that make these things? And we're the ones who span the continent with a railroad? I mean, what has happened? What has happened is transnational corporations have infiltrated their way into government to the point where they've passed legislation that benefits only them and not average working people. And we need to change that. That's what the American people will vote for.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Back with your thoughts on this. I'm curious if you agree with me or disagree with me that Romney's background probably is not going to be that big a liability. Stick with me. That's the good, the bad, and the very, very omnutritiously ugly, brought to you by EdisonFactor.com, a supplement for the brain. The good. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, voted Friday to require broadcasters to post information in an FCC online database on who bought or attempted to buy political ad spots and how much they paid for them. While this new policy doesn't ensure full transparency when it comes to independent political ads, it is a step in the right direction. Right now, thanks to Citizens United, secret donors are throwing millions of dollars into American politics, destroying the power of the people. Along with repealing Citizens United, we need to restore transparency in our government. And this move by the FCC, good start. The bad. Fox News. Thursday and Friday, Fox so-called news eagerly promoted a new attack ad calling President Obama a celebrity president. Nothing new for Fox News, right? Well, the ad was put out by American Crossroads, the super PAC backed by Karl Rove, who just so happens to be a political analyst employed at Fox News. Now, most networks would know that this is a conflict of interest, not Fox News. In less than 24 hours, Fox talking heads raved about the brilliant and devastating ad nearly a dozen times. It was also promoted heavily on the Fox Nation website. We've come to expect Fox News to cross the lines of media ethics, but this is taking it way too far. And the very, very ugly DJ Dominic Dieter. Last week, Dieter, a popular DJ and radio personality in Cleveland, suggested that rape was a good way to turn a lesbian straight. In an email, a listener call told Dieter that he suspected his daughter was a lesbian after he discovered her kissing another girl. On air, Dieter responded saying, "You should have one of your friends to screw your daughter straight." While such an appalling and hateful statement speaks to itself, or for itself, this kind of anti-gay hate speech has no place on America's airwaves or even in our society and is very, very ugly. Well, that's mind-bogglingly ugly. That is incredibly ugly. Just a second, I'm going to plug something in. See if I can get the magic of radio working. Sherry in Linwood, Washington. Hey, Sherry, welcome to the program. What's up?
Hi, thank you. Can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, good. Okay. The only reason I called is because the father who has the conservative sons, I wanted to suggest or would think maybe a good suggestion for him to be would to have his sons read the Paul Krugman, who is a Nobel Prize winner, right, winning economist, on Mondays and Fridays for a while and maybe a few of them back for the last few months. And find out maybe why our country is in such debt, and it'll help them a lot more understand why Obama should read it too, and we should be even more in debt because he should have borrowed more himself. I think.
Yeah, you're right, Sherry. I'm totally with you, and you know, very, very well said. Thank you very much. Paul Krugman is a national icon. I mean, Paul Krugman is incredible. And people do need to be reading him more. Richard in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Oh, I just had a question, or really
couldn't understand the tax thing you were doing where millionaires, you know, only pay 2%. You had the two comparisons of a normal person versus, you know, somebody that doesn't make a lot of money, all of that sort of stuff. And
right.
My understanding is that, you know, Social Security stops at $100,000 worth of, you know, now I think it's $109,000, where you don't contribute anymore.
Right. That's why somebody who's very rich gives a much smaller percentage of their income to Social Security than somebody who's not.
Right, but they don't gain any benefit if they were the government stops them from paying into it because
they gain tremendous benefit from it. They gain the benefit of living in a society where the retired people around them are not living in poverty, and where people who, like my friend Michael Hutchison, who fell and broke his neck and is a quadriplegic right now, I talked to them on the phone last night, who is living on $740 a month, I think it is, Social Security disability. He's not over 65. He's a young man, but he's you know, he can't move anything from the neck up, from the neck down. And fully a third of all those benefits that are paid for by Social Security are for people like Michael, for literally widows and orphans. Those, the fact that we are protecting the most vulnerable in our society and the fact that poverty among elderly is half of what it was before is a tremendous societal benefit. And the fact that, and is one of the reasons why if you live in a country that doesn't have something like this, if you live in a third world nation, and I've worked in a lot of them and I've lived in a couple of them, and you walk out of the, you know, walk out of your house or apartment or walk into the street, and all of a sudden, what do you get? You get hit by all kinds of beggars and people, you know, and rampant diseases and things, tuberculosis and whatnot, all of this kind of stuff. That benefit is accruing to those billionaires, and frankly, they should be paying for it.
Without getting any benefit, like everybody else would, or if they paid more, say they paid their...
They're not getting a cash benefit. They're getting the benefit of living in a society. Social Security is insurance against poverty and disaster. If a billionaire experiences poverty or disaster, then, you know, Social Security is there for them, too. It's not a retirement program. It's not an investment. It is an insurance program. This is the thing that just baffles me about people who don't get it, who have heard this sales pitch over and over and over again. Well, we should just put our Social Security money in the stock market. It's not an old age investment program. It's not there so that you can, you know, retire rich. Social Security, which has been paying out very steadily, very, you know, for years, years and years, is literally for a 25-year-old right now in America. For a 25-year-old, Social Security is a $1.5 to $2 million insurance policy. Because that's about the amount of money that a person would spend, somewhere between $1.5 million and $2 million over the course of their life, if they become completely disabled at the age of 25. And Social Security will cover that. This is an insurance policy against that. And in those countries where there is no such program, and you literally see people, you know, I remember last time I was in India, people rolling around, you know, missing their legs, rolling around on a board with roller skate wheels on it to beg on the streets. And some of them were lepers, I mean, literally with leprosy. And we don't have that here, because we have programs like Social Security. And you say, well, you know, a billionaire doesn't get any benefit from Social Security, so they shouldn't have to pay into it. We cap it at $110,000, $108,600. And so because, you know, they're not going to get any more in. Well, it's not about retirement. It's about the kind of society you want to live in. So anyway, enough of that rant. Liz in Brooklyn, listening on WWRL in New York City. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Every day on my way home from my public school job where I'm a teacher, doing battle with the DOE.
Uh-huh.
And you were mentioning the May Day stuff. Maybe you mentioned it earlier, but they just posted on the HuffPost the huge schedule for the massive day without the 99%.
Yeah, we're doing it all day tomorrow. Our programming is going to be all May Day all day. And I did talk about it when we first opened the show. It's also, May Day used to be, there's a bunch of different dimensions to May Day. Back, you know, hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, it was Beltane, it was the spring ritual of fertility, the maypole and all that. If you go way, way back, it was the time when they would, around the time of the agricultural revolution, 7 to 10,000 years ago, it was the time when they would try to make sure that the land was fertile. They would take symbols of fertility, eggs, and eat them. They would take very fertile animals like rabbits, cut their throats, and sprinkle the blood all over the crops or all over the soil. And thus, you know, we have, and then the goddess of fertility, Ichthar, came to be symbolized of that date. It was around May, and now we've separated out May Day from Easter because we're not, you know, so much on a lunar calendar anymore. But
I should add that to my lesson plan for tomorrow.
Yeah. But it really became political in 1888, wasn't it? Or 1884 was the Haymarket Square riots, which followed by 3 or 4 years, the first real serious suppression of labor in the United States. And some crazy in Chicago threw a bomb and killed a police officer. And it was really in Chicago, in the Haymarket Square, quote, riot. It was actually a peaceful demonstration up until that point. And that really set back the American labor movement for about a generation. But what it did internationally was it created the international labor movement. And in fact, the over 80 countries now officially honor and respect May Day, May 1st, as the day and for many of these countries, in memorial of the martyrs of Haymarket Square. You know, it's like it has become, you know, this whole story around it, even though it was a police officer who died. And,
well, I hope lots of people are going to go out tomorrow, because I was at that PEP meeting last week where they shut down another 20-whatever schools.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, circumventing the collective bargaining process illegally and shutting down all these schools and kicking out half the teachers, and the other half have to try and apply for their jobs again. So,
wow.
It's a complete land grab by the DOE and some of the charter, the big business, and it's happening fast.
That's amazing. Liz, thank you very much for the heads up on that, and thanks for listening to WWRL. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. It is 46 minutes past the hour.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance. Don't even think about it. Seriously. Brian in West Virginia. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really enjoy your show, but I'm kind of a Pat Buchanan conservative when it comes to trade and immigration and stuff like that. I think you got it wrong when it comes to Bill Clinton. I don't think he's sorry for what he did by signing NAFTA, the Commodities Modernization Act, and Glass-Steagall. I think he's just another corporate politician. And also, I don't believe Reagan had any idea that companies would move every job over to China and they'd be bringing in millions of people from India and China to take education.
I'm not sure that Reagan had any idea of anything, Brian. And if you're just calling to trash Bill Clinton, I get it. You know, the Republican Party will send you your $35 or $50. Larry in Leesburg, Iowa. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Well, I'm just curious if you know how many filibusters the Senate has done this year, or in all the time that Obama's been in the office?
Republicans in the Senate? I do not know. I know that it has become routine. And
just wondering how many thousands of them they have in there.
Yeah, the number, it's a Googleable number. I don't have it at the top of my head. What I can tell you is that 20 years ago, 30 years ago, you know, even during the Reagan administration, a filibuster was something that was rare, that was exceptional. It was considered a breach of protocol, basically. It was something that you had to strongly defend and feel passionate about. And now filibusters are so routine that basically they don't even call for filibusters. If Harry Reid can't get 60 votes from the get-go, he doesn't even try the bill. And that's just like, that's not what the Constitution says. The Constitution, and thank you for the call, Larry, on this, the Constitution says, and it says it very explicitly, and it's right there in Article 1, which lays out the nature of our government, the nature of Congress, is that in the United States Senate, it's the second half of legislation. Legislation has to originate in the House. All legislation that has to do with spending or taxation originates in the House, goes to the Senate, and it has to pass the Senate by a majority vote. And in the event that there is not a majority, since each state has two senators, there's an even number of senators. In the event that there's not a majority, that majority will be tied, that tie will be broken by the vice president. So we have 100 senators right now. We have 50 states. Each state has two senators, so that's 100 senators. So a majority would be 50 plus one, 50 votes plus Joe Biden. And yet it takes 60 votes to pass anything. And the people bringing you this are the people who are running around screaming about, we love the Constitution. We're all about the Constitution. The Constitution. Alan West today. The Constitution was being trampled while Obama was at the correspondence dinner. Give me a break. And these are the guys who are saying, oh, yeah, but, you know, without 60 votes, we're not going to do nothing. Ain't going to happen. Kelsey in Los Angeles. Hey, Kelsey, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Great. What's on your mind?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to you all the time. I definitely find you one of the most knowledgeable people, you know, on the radio.
But?
And I agree with you pretty much everything that, you know, that you say. I consider myself pretty much a liberal in every area.
Okay, but? come on. What is
anyways,
it, Kelsey?
Sorry, there was a breakup on the phone for a second.
Uh-huh.
Anyways, there's a couple, once in a while, there's a couple issues that I'm not sure where I stand on, and mm-hmm. I acknowledge that it's probably due to the lack of information, and it's kind of a tax issue. It kind of comes in two parts. But the first part, which will probably lead to the second part, is I heard you say something earlier on the show about how, you know, the rich, you know, if you add up the federal tax rate plus Social Security, state and local tax, they pay about an effective tax rate to the
of 29%. And the median household in the United States, around 60,000, pays an effective tax rate of 28%. Yes.
And so, if that's true, then what are we fighting about as far as, like, you know, the Buffett rule and getting the rich to pay their fair share? If we're already paying about the same amount, then what's the problem in that area?
Oh, slick trick there. What we're fighting about is the fact that out of the Fortune 400. 100 of them paid fewer taxes than you did, and they made a hell of a lot more than you did. That while, you know, when you're talking about the top 1%, you're talking about everybody who makes over about $360,000. That's not the very rich. That's you know, from the well-off to the very rich. The Buffett rule is not targeting the top 1%. The Buffett rule is targeting the top 1/100th of 1%, the top 1/1000th of 1%. Under the Buffett rule, you can make your first $1 million. A full $1 million, $50,000 a week. You can make that. You can make that first $1 million, a quarter of a. Well, no, it wouldn't be $50,000. Whatever it is. Anyhow, you can make your first $1 million, and only pay, like Mitt Romney does, about 15% income tax, because that's the top tax if you're making your money on capital gains, which is how most millionaires make most of their millions. But on the second million, or on your millionth and first dollar, you're gonna have to pay 30% income tax. Now, what's weird to me, I don't understand why conservatives think that this is such a horrible thing, because if you make your living working and you're paid really well, let's say you're the world's greatest brain surgeon and you make $1 million and your money comes as payroll rather than as capital gains or dividend, the way that Mitt Romney makes his money, you pay 36% income tax on every single penny of it, the whole million, and the next million, and the next million. And under the Buffett rule, they're saying, okay, you can pay 15%, Mitt Romney, on that first million, and after that, you will only pay 30%. Not even the 36% that the brain surgeon is paying. And so, I find it somewhere between infuriating and funny when the spokespeople for the right call up and say, well, what are we fighting about here? What's the big deal? It's all, you know, it's fill in the blank rationalization. It's about fairness. It's about the gestalt. It's about the zeitgeist. It's about the spirit of the times, and having fairness once again be something that we take seriously in the United States. Coming up tomorrow, it's May Day. We're going to do wall-to-wall coverage on the Occupy movement and on May Day. Don't forget, democracy begins when you show up, when you participate, when you decide to be part of the solution. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.